This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. In public schools across Seattle this week, teachers and staff members will wear Black Lives Matter t-shirts. Teacher Jesse Hagopian says this might be the first time an entire school district has made a statement like this about violence against the black community. Hagopian teaches history at Garfield High School. He's an organizer of Wednesday's event. He says t-shirt sales alone exceeded his expectations.
We've already had orders for over 2,000 shirts, and we sold out of them so quick we had to make another order of hundreds more. Somebody else got the image and posted it to Amazon, so we don't even know how many have been ordered through there. And other schools are just taking it upon themselves to make banners and buttons with their school mascot on them. So it's really taken off, and it's beautiful to see.
Who's going to wear these shirts? Every teacher? Is it voluntary? Students? What's going to happen?
Totally voluntary. You know, some people feel comfortable making a statement at work, and some people don't. And I respect that decision. But for the teachers that have been traumatized by what they've seen in the news, seemingly day after day, week after week, month after month, of state violence against black and brown bodies, and for those of us who see this crisis and feel the need to express it publicly, this is an action for them. So, you know, many teachers, hundreds of teachers will be wearing Black Lives Matter shirts, and then it says "We Stand Together" on the shirt, and likely many parents will as well.
Will you describe what the problem is? Everybody doesn't know why Black Lives Matter is such an important thing to even say in classrooms right now.
Right. Well, I think that you can see the dramatic disproportionate outcomes for our black students on many levels in the Seattle public schools and across the country. You can see that the graduation rates for black students are lower. You can see that the suspension rates for black students are much higher, four times that of white students in the Seattle public schools. And the segregation is deep as well. When you look at the honors classes in schools across Seattle and the country, they're dramatically disproportionately white, and many times black students aren't encouraged or promoted to go into those higher level courses. And I think that all of those are things that are in our power to change. And I think that this day of action, wearing Black Lives Matter shirts, will raise the potential of addressing all of those issues.
And how important was that incident at John Muir?
Well, it was really
Will you describe
catalyst.
What happened?
Yes, the incident on John Muir was the catalyst for this action. You know, they had been discussing how to support their black students at John Muir Elementary, and a group called Black Men United to Change the Narrative had organized an event to high-five students as they came in and show positive black role models for the students and lead dialogues about supporting and affirming black students that day. And unfortunately, some hateful person made a violent threat against their school for the teacher's audacity to celebrate the black students that day and wear shirts that said Black Lives Matter. And to the teacher's credit, even though the event was canceled, most of the teachers and community members came out anyway. It was smaller than it would have been, which was unfortunate. But seeing our colleagues under attack like that really, I think, spurred educators across Seattle to rise up and say, we have to do something in this moment to stand on the right side of history and to embrace our black students.
As you know, Jesse, the pro-police group Blue Lives Matter says this is grossly inappropriate. They say Seattle Public Schools already has a Close the Gaps campaign focused on eliminating opportunity gaps and improving education for black students, and that you should absolutely wear your Close the Gap t-shirts, not the shirts of this anti-law enforcement group, Black Lives Matter.
Well, I would say, first off, that this is about a social movement, not any one group. right? So this, when we say Black Lives Matter, we're talking about a broad social movement that's going across the country.
You're not endorsing everything the group does. You've taken this phrase as your own.
Exactly. Like many activists all around the country who are not directly affiliated with any one group, but who believe in the simple declaration that Black lives truly do matter and that we have to stand up and say something about that. And it's also important to understand that for Black lives to matter, Black education has to matter, and that this movement is also broader than police accountability, that in a school system as dramatically unequal as ours, it's incumbent upon educators and families to stand up and say something about this.
What do you say to a parent who says, just teach my kid reading, writing, and arithmetic?
I would say it's important to look back at what Dr. Martin Luther King said about education in his famous book called Where Do We Go From Here? And he said that education without social action is of one-sided value. And I think that we're going to get a great education on Wednesday. And that's why I agree with Martin Luther King, that I think education has to help promote imagination and civic courage and critical thinking and civic action. Otherwise, it becomes irrelevant to the students' lives. And it's just been incredible to see the overwhelming support and solidarity from so many parents and students and teachers coming together to say, we can do this together. We can make a change.
Finally, Jesse, what is the message you're hoping your students, what do you want them to be walking away thinking and feeling after Wednesday's show of unity?
I hope that the students begin to discuss the social issues for themselves and set out a plan and a path for empowering themselves. And I hope that this leads students to investigate a whole series of issues related to their education. So I hope this begins a dialogue that can empower families and educators to make the changes we know that our students deserve.
History teacher Jesse Hagopian at Garfield High School. He, along with 1,000 or so other teachers, will be wearing Black Lives Matter t-shirts to school on Wednesday. And there's going to be a rally with parents and teachers and students starting Wednesday at 6 o'clock. That's at Washington Hall in the Central District. And we are tweeting out a link to that event right now at KUOW. Now, here's another important news story for you on KUOW's The Record. A bump in Washington State's minimum wage is on your fall ballot. Initiative 1433 would raise the hourly wage $4 by the year 2020. In one Snohomish County swing district, Republicans and Democrats are battling over this increase, and their struggle might help determine which party controls the state legislature next year. Here's KUOW's David Hyde.
Janice Huxford is going door to door to try to win votes in Mill Creek.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm Janice. I'm out introducing myself to your neighborhood today. Yeah. I'm running for the first time ever for the open seat in the House of Representatives. Awesome. I'm looking forward to serving the district.
Mill Creek is at the heart of the 44th Legislative District. It's a small, affluent city in Snohomish County, about 20 miles north of Seattle. And one of the issues Republican Janice Huxford is talking about is the minimum wage.
My concern is that we are now being told what the state minimum wage should be at an inflated rate across the state. What is good in Mill Creek is different in Roy, is different in Republic.
Huxford co-owns a roofing business in Lake Stevens with her husband, Dave. So who does she think is going to be hurt by a state wage hike?
Absolutely, it's going to be the employee. I think that employers are not going to be able to hire as much as they've wanted to and have been in the past, and certainly it's going to affect those people and their families.
Huxford's opponent, Democrat John Lovick, disagrees that employees are going to be hurt by a state wage hike. Lovick is a former sheriff and county executive for Snohomish County. He was appointed to the open seat in the 44th back in June. And at the Spotted Cow Coffee Shop in Mill Creek, He says this hike is badly needed for minimum wage workers.
It could simply mean more money in their pocket to spend on food, clothes, and the things that they need. And it'll mean a lot to our economy to have those extra dollars to spend.
Can a place like the 44th District, Mill Creek, and the rest of it support it?
It's something that I believe we can support it. When you think about the fact that it's incremental, it's not like tomorrow we're walking up saying, now you have to pay $13.50. They are allowed to phase it in over a period. It's something that I believe we can support it.
Just outside the Mill Creek Library, near the book drop, reactions are also mixed. Ron Farrell is a librarian who supports it.
It would be hard to make a living on $10 an hour, you know, especially by 2020, you know. Raise people up with higher wages, I think, benefits society all the way around.
But Sabrina Zhang is less sure.
I think for the low-income people, maybe that's a good news. But for the small business, if they have to raise the minimum wage, then their cost will be higher. So maybe they will depend on whether they will reduce some employment, or there will not be that incentive to enlarge their business. Yeah, so, yeah, I don't know. It has both sides.
The polling that's been done shows Initiative 1433 to hike the minimum wage has about 60% support statewide. And in the 44th District primary, Democrat John Lovick came out about 4.5 percentage points ahead of Republican Janice Huxford. But voters will have the final say on November 8th. In Mill Creek, Washington, I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In the news today, Donald Trump's been saying this presidential election is rigged. His own running mate says it's not. And so does Democratic vice presidential nominee Tim Kaine.
When you criticize the system, who are you criticizing? You're criticizing American voters, and you're criticizing local elected officials in cities and counties and states who have been run on elections, you know, for decades and decades and decades.
How much does it matter whether Donald Trump accepts the election results? We're going to get into that today on KUOW's All Things Considered. Now, it's looking like third-party candidates might get more votes in this election than they've gotten in decades. Jill Stein in the Green Party, Gary Johnson, the Libertarian, Independent Evan McMullen, not to mention write-in candidates. One of the most successful third-party candidates in modern politics is Ralph Nader. Some people still blame him for the outcome of the 2000 election when George W. Bush became president. Now, in 2016, Ralph Nader's mostly staying out of presidential politics.
I don't endorse because that's like a flat-out support for whatever the candidate does. So I do say nice things and or critical things about candidates as the months go by. I think the best platform, one I ran on, is the Green Party platform, very broad, very deep, from labor, poverty, environment, international military foreign policy, corporate power, good. And I think Jill Stein is pretty faithful to that platform.
Here in Washington State, you can vote for Jill Stein, and we pretty much know Hillary Clinton's going to win Washington. What do you say to voters in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida?
Vote your conscience. Vote for the best candidate. The minute we start tactical voting, we lose our ability to have any leverage. Because when you say, well, let's say Hillary is the least worst compared to Trump, I have to vote for Hillary, you give up your bargaining power. The only thing these major party candidates understand is when they lose votes, when they go into office, and the only leverage you have over them is if you are going to take votes away from them on their effort to be reelected.
A famous example, of course, was in 2000 in the crucial state of Florida when Bush beat Gore by just a few hundred votes, and you got 97,000 votes in Florida. What did you do with that leverage? What was good about that outcome?
Well, that was the scapegoating by the Democratic Party. So they blocked me from testifying in Congress, for example, numerous times. But the scapegoating is an apt term because 300,000 registered Democrats in Florida voted for Bush, not for Gore. And the Secretary of State of Jeb Bush's administration in Tallahassee took away all kinds of votes by misidentifying ex-felons and therefore taking away their right to vote. And, of course, Bush was never elected to anything. He was selected by a 5-4 political decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, blocking the Florida Supreme Court's order for a full state recount. So why blame the Greens for all that?
You say that when a third party becomes very, very relevant, that gives that third party, you said leverage, bargaining power. What was accomplished in 2000?
I think before the election, Gore became more critical of corporations. He went after the oil companies. He went after the insurance companies, the drug companies. And when he looked at my modest polls, and I was told by former people in the campaign that it did adjust his positions. But in the past, Bill, Franklin Delano Roosevelt adopted some of Norman Thomas's Socialist Party challenge, and that's happened throughout history. The small parties put the issues on the table, like the Abolition Party against slavery in 1840, the Women's Right to Vote parties, the Labor Farmer parties. They put them on the table of the big parties, and sooner or later one of them adopts them.
Didn't Bernie Sanders accomplish something like that by running not in a third party but as a Democrat?
Yes, he did, at least rhetorically. I mean, she began to adopt his language. You're quite right about that. Higher minimum wage. She didn't go to $15 like people in Seattle are going to get soon, but she went to $12, and she talked about student loan assistance, things like that. But it doesn't mean that rhetoric is going to apply should she be elected president, because she's been known to talk one way inside business conventions, closed door, without releasing her transcripts, and talk another way on the hustings to the American people.
In just a hypothetical, if somehow in this election a third-party vote were to be the difference and Donald Trump were to squeak into office, what would be good about that?
There wouldn't be anything good about that, but it wouldn't be the third party. It would be the frail Democratic Party that couldn't beat an egomaniac, thin-skinned blusterer, a failed gambling czar, and a corporate welfare king who didn't pay taxes and cheated all his business dealings with workers, creditors, suppliers, and taxpayers. So, I mean, you know, why blame the little Green Party? Blame the big major party that couldn't defend the United States of America from the worst Republican Party in history. I want to show people that they've got to look to themselves. Unless we have citizen movements in this country, the way you have had in Seattle on some economic issues, to shape the political movements, the electoral movements, to participate in demanding different kinds of debates around the country, not just three hoked up debates run by a corporate funded commission on presidential debates, we're not going to get anywhere just being spectators. We got a circus barker, and we got a failed politician who has high unfavorable ratings along with Trump. That's not good enough for the American people. We deserve better.
Will the Trump candidacy and the near Republican civil war help break up the two-party system?
It may break up the Republican Party, Bill. You can see the defections now. Paul Ryan is removing himself from defending Trump. John McCain has already pulled out. Maybe two dozen candidates for Congress have already pulled out. And Trump is attacking them viciously. So he's imploding his own party. The way he's going, the Republican Party is going to be the Trump dump.
A complaint about third parties is that they toss out a presidential candidate every 4 years, but they don't put enough work into congressional and state races where they have a chance to build a movement. How fair is that?
That's very fair. You're quite accurate. Part of it is they don't have any money. The second part is they don't have many local candidates for office, you know, city council, board of education. That helps build the party. And the other part is that these third parties are supported by people who are not long-distance runners. They're more protest, unfortunately. They may be believers in the party, small party platforms. I don't want to deny that. But they too, sort of swallow this defeatism that only one of the two major parties can win. The system is rigged against third parties. And so between elections, they don't rev it up as they should.
getting more traction this year than the Green Party is the Libertarians. Do you root for the Libertarians, too, because at least they're not Republicans or Democrats?
I don't like their opposition to Medicare, to health and safety, life-saving regulation. I don't abide by that at all, but I like their civil liberties position. They want to amend the Patriot Act and protect people's privacy. I like their anti-empire. They want to cut back on the bloated military budget, and they want more diplomacy and peace rather than a brute force foreign policy. And I like their opposition to corporate welfare, which they call crony capitalism, forcing the taxpayers to bail out businesses that are not run properly, mismanaged, or crooked.
If a listener is agreeing with you right now and wants more choice than elephants and donkeys, what's the number one thing they should do?
They should ask their parties or their candidates how much power are they shifting from the few to the voters, the consumers, the workers, people in communities, the taxpayers. If there isn't a shift of power from the few to the many, the few, what's called the plutocracy, or Wall Street connecting to Washington, will decide for the many. And they haven't been making very good decisions in the last 40 years as our economy and society continues to deteriorate.
Talking with Ralph Nader, we've talked about the past and this election. What is your hope for the future?
An aroused citizenry, local, state, and national. That's the brunt of my little book, Breaking Through Power. It's easier than we think. And I give a lot of examples from U.S. history where very few people started turning the country around in health and safety and workers and civil rights, and where people now are doing that. And my thesis is that 1% or less of the American people organized in congressional districts, 435 of them in Congress, representing majority opinion, can defeat the most powerful corporate lobbies around. Because there's only 535 men and women in Congress. What they want more than corporate money are your votes.
Ralph Nader's new book is called Breaking Through Power. It's easier than we think. And you can go hear him for yourself because he'll be at Town Hall Seattle this Friday. Former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders made a campaign stop in Seattle on Saturday at the Showbox. And this time, his rally was not for Bernie Sanders. It was on behalf of Pramila Jayapal, one of the two Democrats running in the 7th Congressional District. Her opponent is Brady Walkinshaw. Here's KUOW reporter Amy Radel.
Sanders told the crowd that if elected to Congress, Jayapal will stand up to the wealthy to advocate for single-payer health care, free college tuition, and raising the federal minimum wage, among other issues. He accused Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump of sexism, misogyny, and racism. Sanders said he'll do everything he can to make sure Trump is not elected president.
And I'm going to do my best to see that Hillary Clinton becomes president. Number two, that's number one. Number two, I am here to see that we elect Pramila to the United States Congress.
Sanders' endorsement of Jayapal got loud applause, but his mention of Hillary Clinton brought some boos from this crowd, many of whom supported him in his presidential bid. Seattle resident Cooper Duell says he was one of the people booing at the mention of Clinton's name. He says he'll gladly vote for Jayapal, but he refuses to support Clinton.
Bernie has been about what he talks about for a long time and has been in that since before he was even cool.
Duell says he doubts Clinton's commitment to gay rights and other issues that are important to him. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
Welcome to The Record, KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. What are you going to do with all those extra flashlight batteries? Our predicted windstorm did not roar after all, at least not in most areas in the Seattle region over the weekend. So let's figure out what happened. Ted Beener is the warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Seattle. Hey, Ted.
Bill, it's been a while since we've talked.
Yeah, well, I'm calling you from a bunker in my yard. Is it safe to come outside?
It is, Bill. But just make sure you have your umbrella and jacket with you.
Okay, thank you. Listen, the I saw the Weather Service had written, yes, our forecast did not turn out as predicted. We're not pleased about it either. I was very pleased that it didn't turn out. Why wouldn't you be pleased?
Well, I think a lot of people gave us flack with regards to how the wind wasn't as strong here in the Puget Sound area as it was anticipated. But, you know, it was an interesting sequence of events last week, Bill. Some of the guidance had the storm center staying just off the coast, while others were carrying it inland right over us, and that is the dangerous path, you know. And it was the responsible thing for us to make sure that people were aware of this particular sequence of events. If that thing came in inland, well, then it would be a much more dangerous storm. But we were also conveying that it could stay offshore and the strong winds would be mainly confined to the coast in the north interior with lighter wind speeds from roughly the central Puget Sound area southward towards Portland.
So do you have any regrets about what you told us could happen?
I think if we had any lessons learned out of this was how to better communicate the different kind of wind and storm track scenarios and the resulting winds and damage that would go with that. We were looking back at a lot of our social media, and we actually were doing that, but only some of them were getting, you know, the widespread circulation as opposed to others that were a little bit more like the 1 in 3 chance the storm is going to come here. That one got wide distribution as opposed to the only 2 out of 3 chance it'll remain offshore. So these are some of the challenges we have now in this era of social media.
Well, let's talk about who besides social media circulates things. What about people like us? Is it the media's fault because we can't resist a storm of the century story?
I don't think it's the media's fault. I think it's just the weather community as a whole, and that includes all of our partners in the broadcast industry, as well as print and web and bloggers, and, you know, go on down the list. And so we're going to try to get everybody together here in the near future to kind of discuss what are the lessons learned here and how can we move forward and improve things down the road. I think the key, and you've got an audience that's pretty well educated.
They're brilliant.
Yes, they are. They are brilliant in comparison to some other
stations
in the area, if you wish.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a better audience that can better understand the sequence of events that can occur here. So in this particular case, the low track from south to north, just off the coast, intensity-wise, the guidance was just about right on track, but the path of this storm is what was the key for who was going to get the strongest winds and where, and who was going to get those, and what kind of impacts that would be result from that.
Well, did somebody else take the bullet for us and you really get walloped hard?
Yeah, there were some places out on the north coast that were well in excess of 70 miles per hour and well in excess of 60 miles per hour. Up on Whidbey Island and up in the San Juans and some of the more exposed places up in there.
Yeah, so let's not be too parochial when you personally didn't get smashed by this thing. Somebody might have.
You know, and you look at it, and it's really fortunate that we had only tens of thousands of people who lost power as opposed to hundreds of thousands of people who lost power. And there were still people who had trees down on vehicles, trees down on their house. But, you know, the bottom line is, and this is what I'm very, very proud of the community at this particular point, they really prepared well as a whole throughout the community for this particular event. We had no loss of life in this event, just a few injuries as a result of this particular event. Nobody got electrocuted. Any of those kinds of things occurred. So everybody really needs to kind of give themselves a pat on the back. Thank everybody for taking this wind event seriously and being prepared, because now you're ready for the next storm. You mentioned the extra batteries. Well, you're ready for that next storm. Or, who knows, we might get that natural no-notice disaster like a big earthquake. It could happen tomorrow.
I've got tons of firewood ready to go.
There you go.
I thought I might have to eat it. I'm so pleased. So, yeah, good on you. And we will partner with you, Ted, and try to tell people what the risks are and aren't every single time. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Ted Buehner, warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Seattle. Now, the non-storm was, of course, very welcome news to Puget Sound Energy, whose job it is to get your lights back on. Puget Sound Energy is Washington's biggest utility company. It is not, though, just energy that they serve up. Our Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins, says PSE helps power campaigns and elections in Washington through their political contributions.
Puget Sound Energy and its predecessors have a 135-year history, from building the region's first hydroelectric dam at Snoqualmie Falls,
in one of the roughest countries man ever tried to conquer,
to Puget Sound Power and Light's role in keeping the lights on through the Great Depression. From the arrival of natural gas in the 1950s all the way to the first wind facilities in 2005.
These windmills, when you go out and see them, are really quite amazing.
Today, PSE is a privately held company whose ownership group includes foreign investors, but its headquarters remain in Bellevue, and it's regulated by Washington's Utilities and Transportation Commission. That helps explain why the company is an active player in state politics.
I think from a company perspective, we believe civic involvement is important, and part of that civic involvement is political involvement.
That's Nancy Atwood, who heads up state government relations for PSE. Since 1997, the company has contributed more than $4 million to Washington campaigns and elections. Some of PSE's biggest spending has gone to defeat local public power initiatives that threaten its service areas. So far this election cycle, the utility has made nearly $250,000 in political contributions, mostly to individual candidates for the legislature, both Democrats and Republicans. But it's also written some bigger checks, including $30,000 to Enterprise Washington, a business-backed political action committee that's worked to keep a Republican majority in the state Senate.
We do give to Enterprise Washington, which is a business group. We also give to Democratic organizations as well. It's not as much about a part of affiliation as it is about sharing the goals that we have for our customers.
Atwood says those goals include providing safe, dependable, and efficient energy at reasonable prices, while also looking to the region's future energy needs. It's not just campaigns and elections that PSE is involved with. The company also has a strong lobbying presence in the halls of the state capitol. Earlier this year, the Washington legislature passed a law that creates a funding mechanism for PSE to wean itself from coal-fired power in Montana. It took two legislative sessions and complex negotiations to hammer out the final bipartisan deal. Through it all, Doug Howell with the Sierra Club says he was reminded of PSE's political firepower.
They had a very big team, and sometimes when they would congregate after a hearing, you would see eight of them huddled.
Howell offers praise for PSE in the negotiations, but he anticipates future political fights with the company over natural gas, which he calls as bad as coal when it comes to climate change. In fact, a couple of years ago, Washington lawmakers passed favorable tax legislation for Puget Sound Energy to build a liquefied natural gas plant at the Port of Tacoma. It was another example of the kind of influence the company has in Olympia.
Yeah, I mean, they literally, you know, found me, might have pulled me off the floor.
This is Democratic State Representative Jake Fye recalling how a lobbyist for PSE tracked him down at the end of the 2014 legislative session. He says the lobbyist was concerned that the tax bill for the new natural gas plant was about to be amended to death in the Washington House.
They came to me and asked me if I could help facilitate getting to the finish line.
Fye had received political contributions from Puget Sound Energy, but he says that's not why he agreed to help. Fye represents Tacoma and has a background in energy issues. He viewed the liquefied natural gas project as good for his district and good for the environment because it would allow ships leaving the port to burn cleaner fuel. A deal was hammered out, and on the next to last day of the legislative session, an amended version of the bill made it through.
Mr. President, 43 yeas, 6 nays.
It wasn't everything PSE had wanted, but it was still a significant win, especially for a short 60-day session when most tax-related bills weren't going anywhere. More recently, PSE has joined a lawsuit challenging Governor Jay Inslee's new carbon cap rule. The company also put $25,000 into a campaign to defeat a carbon tax initiative on the November ballot. These are positions that potentially put PSE at odds with its politically liberal and environmentally minded customer base in the Puget Sound region. The company says it supports reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but in a fashion that's cost-effective. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
You're with KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. This summer, City Arts Magazine did a cover story on Seattle's Larry Mizell Jr. The story put Mizell at the center of what the author called a black renaissance in Seattle. Mizell hosted Street Sounds, the weekly hip-hop show on KEXP. He wrote the column My Philosophy for The Stranger. He was in local bands like Cancer Rising and Don't Talk to the Cops. After 25 years in Seattle, Mizell has left for Los Angeles. He says Seattle wasn't giving him what he needed anymore.
Yeah, I felt like I was going to the well one too many times and not getting any sustenance, whereas I would go to New York or I would go to L.A. or Miami or wherever and be around a lot more black and brown people, and I'd be like, oh, God. And my batteries would get charged just by being around communities that were like disappearing in Seattle, and I would find that it was giving me life that I didn't know was leaving me at home. And it just got more stark.
Well, let's talk about diverse for a second. Your fellow DJ and writer, Riz Rollins, just wrote, "The overall population of people of color in Seattle is slowly shrinking, but our voices are getting stronger." What do you think of that?
I think that's totally true because of that pressure. As people are getting pushed out, of course, people's voices are getting louder. People's voices are getting louder as all sorts of things are happening, as injustice is happening. So I'm not surprised by that. It can also be a lot to hold if you find yourself the one in the room that has to, like, amplify your voice for dire reasons, you know. It can be a lot to hold.
Larry, you said that you felt somehow tokenized in Seattle. Is that fair?
You know, I don't think Seattle necessarily tokenized me, but doing what I was doing would put me in rooms where I'd be the only person of color and the only person kind of with vested interest in the culture of people of color. And that's dope. And I'm there to rep and to put it down. But to feel like the only person, after a while, that's going to wear you down. And yeah, I feel like after a while in Seattle, if you're trying to do stuff on a real significant level, just because of the demographics in that town, you're going to be in a lot of all-white rooms. So you kind of have to decide what kind of token you want to be. And that can really wear down on you after a while. So that is something I wanted to get away from. And it's nobody's fault.
It's not?
I don't think it's anybody's fault. It's a machine, you know?
I ask because we work at that, Larry, and we're not. It's not like it's nobody's fault. We're individuals here at KUOW who make decisions, and we make an effort. It's not always obvious who we're going to talk to, and you know, just who's going to be in that room.
Sure, sure. That's absolutely right. So yeah, there is absolutely some personal responsibility that every organization and individual within it should be taking to make sure that that's not the case, and it's not the same types of people that are making these calls all the time, but that is still the lay of the land for the most part. And there is work being done, I'm sure, within your organization and all the others I've been a part of. And it's been fantastic. It just feels like I think somebody else should benefit from seeing that progress happen, because I'm a little burnt out personally. I'd rather take a knee and be in a place where it's truly a melting pot. You know what I mean?
You also have talked about feeling crusty and barnacly, and maybe that was completely yeah. about you personally, but I wondered if you feel like, you know, anybody here can be start to be mossy or crusty. Should everybody leave Seattle at some point?
Well, honestly, yes, everybody should leave Seattle at some point. I don't mean they need to move away, but they definitely should get out. And I only say that because Seattle in particular seems to have this kind of snobbish about its values and its way of life and everything. And get kind of, there's kind of like a smug Northwest character. There's a smug Northwest kind of character, like, oh, the rest of the world should be like us, and I'm driving a Subaru and wearing Patagonia, and
well, why shouldn't the world, you know? Rest of the world be like us?
Because the rest of the world should be like the rest of the world, and, you know, we should all work together. Like, wanting it all to be one way is, you know, it's fascism. Even if it's well-intentioned, I think it's important to understand that there's different ways of getting to the goal of skinning that particular cat.
I feel like some people listening to this are going to feel like we're dumping on Seattle by talking so much about what you're leaving and why. I don't feel that way, because to me, I find an immigrant story, I find somebody who picks up and moves, I find that upbeat and inspiring, even if they're leaving my town, even if I'll miss you, you know? But I feel like some people will just feel we're being downers about their home.
I don't want anybody to think that, because I love Seattle. Like, I love Seattle, and I'll defend it to the death. And I always have. And I was really invested in a scene of creatives in Seattle being proud of the place. And it wasn't because of me, but I was in the mix for the time when that polarity shifted, and it went from people not really having that really essential, especially to hip-hop, that essential pride in that soil, you know, to being completely over the top proud, almost jingoistic about Seattle, you know?
Right.
And I think that that's fantastic. Like, people have to be proud of the place. They have to, like, rep it. It's hip-hop. You have to do that. It's not where you're from, it's where you're at, and so forth. But where you're at and where you're from, both very important.
Well, then what's the best Seattle can be if it's going to be white and now, thanks to you, one guy whiter?
Well, you know, it's hard to say what Seattle's going to be. It's moving in a direction where it seems to be shooting straight up and really focused on tech, and there's a lot of money there, a lot of resources, and that's awesome. But I think that the people who are fighting for the cultural health of that place have to make their voices louder and dig in. And the people who are fighting to live and fighting injustices there have to be louder and dig in. But my own mental state led me to believe that I need to be in another state, at least for a while. But I'm forever going to be tied to Seattle. That's part of my heart, forever.
Larry Mazel Jr., earlier this month, after 25 years in Seattle, he moved to Los Angeles and published his farewell column in The Stranger in September. And some readers really sounded moved by it. One of them wrote, "I'm tearing up a little." One of them wrote, "Thank you for everything you did and do to lift Seattle." And another said, "Farewell, Mr. Mazel. May you always fly." We're tweeting out a link to his final My Philosophy column for The Stranger. So join us at KUOW. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you've tuned in today. You know, what Amazon does is always of great interest to us around here. And the latest is that the company has launched a new music streaming service. We already have music streaming services. So what is Amazon up to? What makes this special? We have a reporter and producer from the Seattle tech news site GeekWire, Monica Nicholsberg. Hi, Monica.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This is called Amazon Music Unlimited. What's the big deal?
So last week, Amazon announced that they're rolling out this music streaming service for $4 a month, which is less than half of the cost of Spotify and Apple Music. So it's kind of a big deal. But there's a catch. To get that service, you can only have it on one Echo device. So that's the Amazon Echo, the Echo Dot, or the Amazon Tap.
So I can't play my music on my cell phone?
No, if you want it at that price point, your option is to play it in your home on your Echo device.
Okay. And only one of them?
And only one of them.
So what's so great about the service that's what I want to do?
Well, there are a couple other options. If you do want to have it on your phone and on your computer and your Echo, you can sign up for the $10 a month service, which is the same price as Spotify and Apple Music. If you're a Prime subscriber, you can get it for $8 a month. So there is a little bit of a price edge there.
Okay. You said you have an Echo device. What is the experience of streaming my music on an Echo compared to doing it any other way?
So I don't have Amazon Music Unlimited installed on my Echo, although she really would like, Alexa would really like me to. That's the personality that powers it.
She's badgering you about that?
She is a little bit, yeah. Mm. But I do have Spotify, and my understanding is that the experience with Amazon Music Unlimited is a lot more sophisticated than it would be listening to Spotify on the Echo.
Do you, is the idea you're talking through the music you want to listen to? Like, Alexa, play me, who's the guy who won the Nobel Prize for Literature? Play me a song by that guy.
You mean Bob Dylan?
And you would say, do you mean Bob Dylan?
So
is it that chatty or what?
It's pretty chatty, and she has some other smarts too. She can listen to you say or sing the lyrics of a song if you've just got something stuck in your head and you really want to know what it is. She can identify it through her library by just hearing you say a few words, even if you miss a word or two.
Alexa, play the song with the dancing child in his Chinese suit. He spoke to me. I took his flute. And then she would respond to that.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, she would do her best.
Okay. this might sound like an ad for Amazon's music service, which it's not. I want to know why this is. We already have Spotify. We already have Apple Music. Why would somebody bother getting yet another account or trying something new? It sounds pretty simple. I can stream on my phone with Spotify if I want.
Yeah, it's a good question. So I have Spotify, and I'm not likely to change over to Amazon Music. And I think that they know that. What I think that they're targeting here is maybe you're a Prime subscriber, and you are sort of just going off of their Prime Music, which has 2 million songs, versus this new service, which has tens of millions. And they think, okay, for a few extra dollars a month, these people are going to want to sign up for this great service. Or it's somebody who hasn't committed to an Apple Music or a Spotify yet, and they're hoping to capture that market. How big that is, we don't really know.
Well, that's my next question. Amazon is, of course, thinking strategically about what it's going to pour a bunch of money into. In 2016, as I say, we have other companies that will stream somebody else's music for you. How is that a big lucrative deal for them?
So what this is really about is the smart home. Amazon has this competitive edge because they were the first to the market with the Amazon Echo, and it was kind of a surprise hit. You know, it's really taken off in this way that people didn't expect. And what they want to do now is really own that home entertainment, that connected home experience, and streaming music is a big part of that.
Okay. So this is really more about the Echo as like a nose under the tent.
It's about the Echo, it's about Alexa, and it's just about the fact that at the end of the day, Amazon wants to be the everything store. They want to sell you everything you'll ever buy.
Okay, anything else we should know about Amazon Music Unlimited, Monica?
It does have some other features, so if people are interested, they can check them out. But time will tell whether it really gives them the opportunity to compete with Spotify, which is the industry juggernaut.
We'll find out, and if not, they can just drop it like a hot potato and move on to some other segment of the market. Monica Nicholsberg, reporter and producer with the Seattle tech news site GeekWire. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Finally, we had a passionate debate on the show last week over what Seattle should do about homeless campers. Should they be allowed to camp on public lands? And our social media producer, Bond Huberman, is with us. And Bond, we heard a lot from listeners. Can we pass some of that on?
Yes, absolutely. I was impressed that a lot of them had solutions that they wanted to offer up. For example, Barbara wrote, "Winter is coming. Dispersed remote camps in wooded areas is bad public policy. We need to create more housing in downtown Seattle."
Yes. John says, this is John, who works for a local real estate company, suggests we procure a parking garage downtown to allow homeless people to camp in. It would at least get people out of the rain.
Roberta suggests we look at Olympia's Housing First program, which is known as Sidewalk. Apparently that's been successful.
And Dane called and made a passionate case for a minimum basic income, trying to get at the possible root of the problem.
Meanwhile, Carol says, why can't existing shelter policy be tweaked so that pets are allowed in some shelters or maybe some areas of shelters? And why can't the city buy day use lockers for shelter users so that their belongings can be secured?
And one more. Tom writes to us, urban campers are best served by being in the public eye and where police and social services can protect their safety and property. Society should not sweep this vulnerable population under the rug of green space. Thank you for those. We are certainly not sweeping anything under the rug. We want to keep reporting on Seattle's homelessness crisis here on KUOW's The Record. In fact, I really recommend an almost hour-long documentary that our reporters Joshua McNichols and Kate Walters did together called Out of the Jungle. It brings some of the voices, some of the people dealing with homelessness and how the city and these social service agencies have battled to get homelessness under control. We get at root causes. It's a terrific piece of work that you can find at KUOW.org, Out of the Jungle. And if you have ideas, please send us your ideas, your stories, your arguments, your passion to record@KUOW.org. And thanks for tuning in.